From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! Plans for a national Black political convention this summer in Washington, a follow-up to the Million Man March, but what's on the agenda? A report from Los Angeles on the anniversary of the gang truce and what Black-Latino coalitions could mean in an election year.
Listen to the concerns and the needs of the other people of the United States, because we're no longer willing to sit back and let people who are detached away from our communities make decisions for us. And so if you're not willing to comply and do what needs to be done in order to create some type of effective change down in our community, then we're going to get your ass up out of office.
And we've heard plenty about the financial dealings of First Lady Hillary Rodham Clinton, but what about Elizabeth Hanford Dole?
I guess what I found fascinating about Elizabeth Dole was that if there is a woman close to the Oval Office who is a committed career woman who has really pursued power in her own right, more than almost any woman who's in the history of the country who's been anywhere near that job, it's Elizabeth Dole.
The second part of our interview with Jane Mayer of The New Yorker magazine, coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! You're listening to Democracy Now!, Public Broadcasting's only daily election show. I'm Amy Goodman. Longtime contributors to Senator Bob Dole began making large donations to the American Red Cross after his wife became the charity's president in 1991. That's the story in today's edition of the Washington Post. It reports that several interests controlled by agribusiness mogul Duane Andreas have given about $3 million to Red Cross since Elizabeth Dole assumed her post. Andreas is chair of Archer Daniels Midland, or ADM, American Financial Corporation, and a foundation tied to the American International Group Insurance Conglomerate, also donated money and services to the American Red Cross after Mrs. Dole became its president. While this newfound interest in the charity underscores Mrs. Dole's fundraising power, the Post quoted a private ethics watchdog as saying it poses a conflict with her husband's government status. Norman Augustine, chair of the Red Cross Board and chief executive officer of Lockheed Martin, told the Post that Mrs. Dole has done an extraordinary job in keeping her role separate. The Post said the Andreas Foundation gave nothing to the Red Cross in the 5 years before she became its president, but contributed $500,000 in 1991 and another $500,000 in 1992. We're going to talk about Elizabeth Dole and her finances later in the show. But right now, on Thursdays, we often bring you a segment we call Living Democracy, stories of grassroots activists who are working to make a difference in their communities. And over the past few weeks on Democracy Now!, we've talked about efforts to build political coalitions between African Americans and Latinos, both in legislatures and on the grassroots level. One example of that Black-Brown unity is the gang truce that grew out of the Los Angeles uprising 4 years ago. This past weekend, activists and gang members celebrated the fourth anniversary of their truce, which was held even though conditions in L.A. have not improved. Fernando Velasquez of Pacifica Station KPFK has our report.
Under tight police security, gang members, rap musicians, dancers, and community activists spent several hours doing what they called writing history. Since the mid-1980s, gangs in Los Angeles have called for an end to hostilities. And many have attempted to do so, but not all efforts have turned into a success story. Dwayne Holmes is one of the organizers of the truce between the Crips and the Bloods.
I see people of all races, creeds, and colors. And I see people of the past, people of the present, and I see the children, which is our future. This is about us coming together with some plan of action for our future. And for the future of our children.
Lift every voice and sing.
And many children were there to hear the message and celebrate the gang truce. Latino and African American parents were proud to see their young ones involved in a peacemaking effort. Again, Duane Holmes.
And so we're not here on no racial issue. We're not here about Black folks, or we're not here about brown folks. We're here about people, poor people. People are hungry. People are starving. People are tired of putting up with the mess that they've been putting up with. And people who are ready to do something about it. We're going to start doing something about the problems in our community today.
For Mario Cepeda, a high school student, Latinos and African Americans working together is a wish he had for a year, since he overheard a conversation among local sheriffs.
You know, they were fighting in the streets and everything. And the sheriffs came in, you know, and I thought they were going to break it up. They blocked off the streets, and I heard one of the sheriffs say, let them kill each other. You know, all we have to do is just pick up the bodies when they're finished. It's easier for us. You know, I heard that, and I said, damn, they don't care about us, you know. All they want to do is just get rid of us, you know. Instead of, you know, being out here on the streets, killing each other and fighting against each other, we need to unite.
Mello works with the Black Awareness Community Development Organization, which provides support for former prison inmates.
Why do my brothers fight and kill each other? Not even our sisters can get along. Tell me, what is wrong? Did the system mislead you? If so, you must regroup and take charge of your own destiny. Set yourself free.
Maria Teixeira works with the Dolores Mission Project from East Los Angeles. She says she wants to see whites in everyone involved in solving community issues. No one has a monopoly in finding the answers, she claims.
People are starting to get hit in a lot of ways by the crisis in this country. And when you get hit by the crisis, you lose your job or the wage goes down or whatever happens, you start to blame the person you see right in front of you or the person that the media portrays as your enemy. All of us are getting hit, and the problem is the same. You know, we have job loss, we have cuts in government programs and services, and we're all victims of it. And it doesn't make any sense for the victims to be fighting with each other. It's a very positive thing that Chicanos, Latinos are starting to look at history, not just their own, but other people's, and not look at it in a jealous way, but instead say, okay, well, what can we learn from that? How are our histories intertwined so that we can learn and build a movement of humanity, not of one color, this color, that color, but of humanity, so that we can have a country where everybody lives decently.
Steve Teixeira works for La Tribuna del Pueblo, a local newspaper. He's full of praise for the gang truth in Watts.
Even the city and the LAPD have admitted that here in Watts, the truce has held for 4 years. When the Crips Blood truce started in Watts, a lot of other areas also started truces, and they didn't hold the way it held here. Here in Watts, they've done something special. They brought the community. They recognize we're fighting the structures of power in this government, not races, not gangs, not barrios. As a people, we have to unite.
Another day in L.A., a young brother, trying to stay alive, he thinks struggling against the way to survive. He used to be your mama's boy, chilling in school, until he noticed that the gangsters wrote the rules.
Local and national media continue to report divisions among Latino and African Americans. Steve Teixeira says that when the violence breaks out between individuals, the reporters blow it out of proportion.
When they hear that there was a fight between a black and a Latino in Watts, the cameras will roll to get it. But when those camera crews drive by the high school, they'll have seen 60 blacks and Chicanos playing basketball. No one gets out of the car and videotapes. Look at 60 people uniting. There were 5 in the fight. No one's looking at that. We don't pass by the stores. We're all walking in and out and saludando and shopping in peace and tranquility. For some reason, here in Watts, where the vast majority of people of all races are getting together, that's not a story because it's everyday reality. They're looking for what's different, and the divisions is what's different.
The mainstream media may be ignoring the mobilization of Latinos and African Americans in Los Angeles and in other parts of the country. But Maria Teixeira says the press will soon have to pay attention, especially in this election year.
The message that's being sent, not just by this rally or this movement, but throughout the country, is that people are sick and tired of the existing parties, the Democrats and the Republicans, that are a joke. They don't represent our interests. They represent big business. They represent money. They represent, you know, the ruling powers. And people are waking up. People are saying, we need something else. And I think across the country, we're going to see, it's already starting, even though it's the beginning motion of it, but we're already seeing that people want to build a new movement and a new country, and I think that that's the message.
Dwayne Holmes has a message for President Clinton and others who are running for office.
I would encourage them to listen to the people of the United States, to listen to the concerns and the needs of the people of the United States, because we're no longer willing to sit back and let people who are detached away from our communities make decisions for us. And so if you're not willing to comply and do what needs to be done in order to create some type of effective change down in our community, then we're going to get your ass up out of office.
Pahom says it's not Clinton and other elected officials who will make the difference. He says it's up to the citizens to take control of their community.
Take inventory of your communities and begin to rebuild and claim your communities for yourself. You live there, you are affected by the conditions in there, and don't let anyone else tell you otherwise. Those are your communities, and if any type of change is going to take place in your community, it's going to be as a result of you doing something about it, because no one else is going to do anything about it for you.
To see another black brother live a day in L.A. It's just a day in L.A., y'all.
Los Angeles is home to people from every corner of the earth, and in any given day, over 80 languages are spoken here. Without a doubt, this city is a unique social laboratory. And if the violence can be controlled here, it may well become an example for the rest of the country. Organizers feel optimistic so far. This is Fernando Velasquez.
A brother on another for messing with his wife. Think it was a blur when he pulled the trigger. I hate this watermelon fried cheese.
And we want to thank you very much for that report, Fernando, from our Pacifica station, KPFK in Los Angeles. You're listening to Democracy Now! We're now going to turn to Dr. Ben Chavis, convener of the National African American Leadership Summit and executive director of the Million Man March, and Ajua Ayatoro, national director of the National Conference of Black Lawyers. My co-host is joining me from Chicago, Salim Wakil, senior editor at In These Times and columnist for the Chicago Sun-Times. Nice to have you with us, Salim.
Good to be with you, Amy. And just listening to that report from L.A. Indicated just how it's seemingly restless African-Americans and others in this country are for some political representation. And one indication of that restlessness, I think we could safely say, was last year's Million Man March, although there has yet to be much public policy result from the march. There still was an expression of discontent with the political system, and one of those expressions was later enunciated by members of the National African American Leadership Summit, which was convened by Dr. Benjamin Chavis. One of the spokesmen for the summit noted that there was plans for a political convention after the two conventions of the Republicans and the Democrats this summer. Also there was supposed to be an agenda conference coming up in the spring. And I hear much talk about that, but I haven't yet to see any concrete indication that those conventions are to be held, will actually be held. And Dr. Chavis is with us. Dr. Chavis, perhaps you can straighten me out on this.
How are you?
I'm doing well. How are you doing?
Very good. Well, first of all, your report is accurate in the sense that the Million Man March was a tremendous display of unprecedented mobilization in the African American community, and since that time, there has been an outreach to the Latino, Asian American, Native American, and even to progressive white community. There is a restlessness in this political year of 1996.
Indeed,
we still plan to sponsor. That is, the National African American Leadership Summit still plans to sponsor a national political convention in the fall. And as far as the issues conference, the conference is going to be more of hearings that are being planned.
The agenda conference that originally was planned for this spring will be instead a set of hearings?
Well, the agenda conference is going to be national agenda hearings.
Okay.
And after consulting with a number of grassroots groups around the country, the feeling was that it was rather elitist to try to get one conference in one place for people to travel to build a national agenda. But rather what needs to be happening is that it needs to be a movement around the country where local communities can build the agenda from the bottom up. You know, we established 300 local organizing committees for the Million Man March all over the country.
Mm-hmm.
And those local organizers have been given instructions to convene hearings at the grassroots level so that the agenda that will be built prior to the Democratic and Republican convention will have significant grassroots input. Usually what happens in body politics in America, agendas are built from the top down, and they're not well representative of the grassroots.
And this and you attempt to change that tendency by going around to different cities.
Absolutely. I'm on a tour right now. I was just in Los Angeles yesterday. We've been to 9 cities already. We'll be in Boston and New York within a week, and back to Oakland. And the reception has been very good in all the cities we've been in so far.
Well, what are the plans for the actual hearings? What dates have any dates been set? And what are the items that will be discussed on the agenda?
Yes. Well, first of all, in some local communities, hearings have already been held. There will be a national hearing, if you will. Again, I don't want to premature announce it, but my feeling is it will probably be in Washington, D.C., prior to the Democratic and Republican conventions. There are a number of things going on. For example, in Chicago in July, all of the black doctors, the black lawyers, the pharmacists, the nurses, there are about 14 professional black organizations are going to hold concurrent conventions in the same city in Chicago. And on August the 3rd, there will be a session where all these groups will have their representatives, where I will be speaking also about our preparation for the convention in the fall. We are going to be working with some members of the Congressional Black Caucus.
What will that meeting be for? Dr. Chavis, what will that meeting be for? The health professionals, what will they be meeting for?
They will be meeting as health professionals, law professionals, and economic professionals.
Okay.
They're meeting on developing public policy. You had mentioned about the public policy things.
Mm-hmm.
Well, briefing
mm-hmm.
papers on a wide range of public policy issues are now being prepared. Those briefing papers will be presented at this joint conference in Chicago. But there also will be a prelude to the kind of written agendas that will be presented at a national convention. Again, there's a lot of preparatory work. The reason why you haven't seen much about this in the media, we deliberately did not want to over-forecast what we are doing, but to work quietly in our communities to build a basis for developing a national black political agenda. You recall the Gary Convention.
Mm-hmm.
We went to Gary without without an agenda, and we left with an agenda, but it was very difficult.
That was in 1972, right?
72. It was very difficult to implement that agenda because it was built primarily at a national meeting, and people had to go back and try to convince their local communities that this was the agenda. And we spent a lot of time in 72 arguing back and forth whether or not this was the agenda. What we're going to do in 96 is build the agenda, I want to emphasize, before the convention.
Let me bring Adjua Iyatoro into the conversation, who's here in our Washington studios, National Director of the National Conference of Black Lawyers. There was some dissension before the Million Man March about the involvement of women, and that if women weren't at the table there in deciding the agenda, then they were never going to be equals as politics developed after that. Now, this convention that's planned, as I understand it, is certainly for men and women. How have you been a part of this?
We haven't been directly involved at this time. The National Conference of Black Lawyers is in the process of making deliberations as to whether it will at least submit a formal request to the National African American Leadership Summit to become a formal member of the organization.
Right.
What we have done up until now, Reverend Chavis, from its inception of NAIL, from the inception of NAILS, has reached out to some of our membership and leadership to participate in NAILS and to provide support services and technical services. I attended one of the days of the NAILS Summit back in Washington, D.C. in November and have attempted as best I could with raising the issue of gender within NAILS as we raised it within the Million Man March. We are, of course, watching very carefully and hopefully the development of NAILS, and as it develops, we'll make a final determination as to whether we'll formally become a member.
Yes, I want to emphasize that Audra has played an excellent leadership role. First of all, the National Conference of Black Lawyers, just in general, been an advocate for our people in the legal sense where there's a big void.
Dr. Venchavis, we're going to have to break for a minute, but we're going to come back to talk about the agenda of the National Black Political Convention in just a minute. We're joined by Adjua Ayatoro, Director of National Conference of Black Lawyers, and Dr. Venchavis, convener of NAILS, the National African American Leadership Summit, and Executive Director of the Million Man March. I'm Amy Goodman with Salim Wakil in Chicago. You're listening to Democracy Now! You're listening to Democracy Now!, Pacifica Radio's daily grassroots election show. I'm Amy Goodman here in Washington, Salim Wakil with me in Chicago. Our guest, Dr. Venchavis, convener of the National African American Leadership Summit, or NAILS, and executive director of the Million Man March, and Adjua Ayatoro with us in the studio, director of the National Conference of Black Lawyers. I wanted to pursue this point, Adjua, of the issue of gender in black politics today as we're seeing it develop and possibly go toward this convention, since you're involved with this. What do you see as essential in bringing back together men and women, and how women have been dealt with so far?
Well, I think it's essential that we have a real open and honest discussion around gender and the role gender has had in our organizing. I think we attempted to raise it, and when I say we, I know myself as a director of NCBL has raised it with Ben. Even before the Million Man March was realized, the tremendous outpouring that came about as the Million Man March, I think also raised for us and for many of us the issue of how are we addressing the issue of gender. There were women who took a very extreme position and refused to support it. In fact, were very openly hostile and critical towards it. There were other men and women, but led by a number of noted women. There were other women, such as myself, who took a position that we must support this type of mass mobilization and organization of our people, but at the same time, we must raise the fact that we cannot issue a call to a march that says that women should perform traditional roles, that if we're going to have an all-male march, that the definition of that all-male march has to be clear, and has to be clear that it is not reinforcing patriarchy, but in fact, sir, is serving as a basis for a springboard for our communities. And then there were others who felt that there was no problem at all with calling for a Million Man March. I think that it raises and continues to raise, and we talked about this some at the NAILS conference in November. An ad hoc committee was formed of a number of women that we have not been able to move forward. I think, one, because no one was identified as the leadership of that ad hoc committee, which always kind of falls flat.
Right.
But I think that it is clear that that I know Ben, Reverend Chavis, I'm sorry to be so informal on the radio.
That's right.
Is very aware that this is a serious problem, and one at which it raises some concern for me in terms of, quite honestly, Reverend Chavis, the whole issue of organizing, even within the local organizing committees, because we have gotten a lot of feedback from some of the women who are attempting to work with those committees that they continue to work on the basis of very stereotypic roles for women,
right,
and non-inclusiveness
of
women's leadership.
A number of the local organizing committees are headed, in fact, by women.
Yeah, but you know, headed by women, I mean, is sometimes, I mean, there were women who led things in the Million Man March, but they were really not leaders of it. You know, they were the leaders of the work of it, and that has traditionally been one of the problems that we have found, not only in the black community, but I would dare say in all communities where there is rampant sexism,
or the
women are the workers, and you may give them a title of co-chair or chair, but when they have only the work part of it and don't have any of the
I want to assure you that attorney Ife Williams was a figurehead, co-chair. She, in fact, was the chair. Mm-hmm. Has worked hard, and that committee has met. That's the D.C. Local Organizing Committee. They have not missed a week. They meet every Thursday night since the Million Man March, and that committee has grown significantly. They publish a regular newsletter now. And around the country, if I just want to clear up, the role of women in making the Million Man March the tremendous success that it was very significant. We would not have had a successful mobilization of almost 2 million black men if it had not been for the role, the leadership role, not just the supportive role, of black women. But the issue that Audra is raising, as Mireille, the gender, is a real issue. We're not going to try to duck that issue. It is an issue, and it is an issue that we must grapple with. I think that, obviously, there has to be equity, there has to be unity, and we must ensure and make sure that the leadership and involvement of our sisters is equal to that the leadership and involvement of our brothers. That is the goal. We're working toward that. National African American Leadership Summit, we're an organization of organizations, and some of those organizations are led by men. But our principle, in terms of uniting and organizing, must be very clear. This week, our coordinating council is going to meet, Audra, in Washington, where we're going to deal. This issue is on the agenda this Saturday.
Dr. Chavis, the questions that Audra raises about women, the way NAALS, the National African American Leadership Summit, relates to women is an issue that's been raised by other progressive forces in the black community about the organization itself. And your particular ideological stance and your previous positions, you clearly identified yourself as a force for progressive politics. You pushed for multiracial coalitions. You're a strong advocate of gay rights and feminist principles, and you pioneered struggles like the one against environmental racism, and those kinds of broad alliances. But now you seem to be traveling down the road of black nationalism, and you mentioned Gary, for example. One of the more interesting aspects of what happened in Gary, Indiana, is they just elected a white mayor. This is a predominantly black city that just elected a white mayor,
right,
which in some ways is expressing another kind of discontent and restlessness within the African-American community. How do you respond to critics who say that you are beginning to align yourself too closely with the kind of conservative forces of Louis Farrakhan?
Well, first of all, we all evolve, and I think that I have dedicated my life to working to build broad-based unity within the African-American community, but also to outreach. And again, I don't want to be premature, but the convention that we're planning for the fall will not be exclusively black. We're going to outreach to Latinos, to Native Americans, and to others that are impacted. It's going to be more of a convention of the oppressed. And when we have hearings...
Is this a scoop?
Those
I haven't
hearings.
Heard this before.
Pardon?
Are we getting a scoop here, Dr. Davis?
Well, I'm just saying that as we have moved around the United States... Now, see, this is the value of letting the grassroots speak to you. Mm-hmm. As we've moved around the country, I'm telling you that blacks and Latinos are building more grassroots unity now than ever before. So how can we then have a national convention that ignores that fact? You see what I'm saying?
Absolutely.
So the people have to speak, and a lot of people give rhetoricize about the masses, rhetoricize about getting input from the grassroots. But when you, in fact, try to do that, you have some obligation to listen to what people are saying at the community level. And it's not so much me becoming more conservative. No, I'm still the Ben Chavis. But I do have a relationship with the Honorable Minister Louis Farrakhan of the Nation of Islam that I'm very proud of. I'm trying to build unity between black Christians and black Muslims. I'm trying to build unity among the nationalists, among the Pan-Africanists, among progressive blacks. I think it's very possible for the disparate and oppressed forces in our society to, in fact, unite. In fact, if we unite, we can have a much better effectiveness of challenging the right-wing direction which the United States is clearly headed.
Let me ask
I agree. I agree, but and it's all and also there's, let me add this to your defense as well. There are indications that Minister Louis Farrakhan has altered many of his previously held positions because of an association.
I would say he's evolving. Like we all evolved. Like Malcolm evolved. Martin Luther King Jr. evolved. The Honorable Minister Louis Farrakhan is evolving. Ben Chavis evolved. Arjua is evolving.
But Dr. Chavis, do you consider evolving, for example, this African tour that Farrakhan took? And I know you were standing with him when he reported back, gave his big speech in Chicago on it. Do you consider it progress and evolution to stand with Sonny Abacha, the military dictator of Nigeria who killed Ken Saro-Wiwa?
I'm so glad you raised that because, you know, again, the media seems not to be very open-minded about this. The fact of the matter is, when Ms. Farrakhan went to Nigeria, he just didn't stand with Abacha. He met with Abacha, but he also met with Abiola, the opposition. He also went to the place where the people had been hung and met with their families, met with both sides. This was a tour to spread the spirit of the Million Man March. And what is that spirit? The spirit of God, the spirit of atonement, the spirit of unity, the spirit of responsibility. So we were not taking sides in the world tour. We were trying to mediate. We were trying to promote unity, to promote dialogue.
I didn't hear him speak about Ken Saro-Wiwa.
Oh, he did.
And talk about what his struggle was all about.
He talked about the fact that he was not the mission to Nigeria was not one-sided.
Ajua Ayotoro.
I guess so. I'd like to kind of bring the discussion back because one of the frustrations that I have, and I'm sure many of your listeners share it, is that we make the issue Minister Farrakhan as opposed to the issue being the need for unity.
That's right.
Not only within our community, but also across communities. The issues that are the things that are affecting us seriously, significantly right now today, the criminal punishment system, I don't call it a justice system because it's not a justice system. The criminal punishment system is disproportionately impacting people of color, particularly black people, men and women. And that's another reason why I think that we have to be very, very concerned about dealing just with men issues. Black women are going into the criminal punishment system at a faster rate of anybody else in this society.
That's right.
Even though the absolute numbers are lower. We have the issues of poverty that are part of that criminal punishment system, but also beyond it. We have the issues of health care in our communities. We have a tremendous number of issues. Our community is dying in so many ways, but then there's a lot of growth that is not being shown in our communities.
Right.
We have young people who are doing positive things in our community that are not getting shown. And I think that it is a disservice to our communities and to the organizing that we're doing. Many of us have been organizing and working for years to attempt to defend and build our communities, that we constantly get taken off by the charismatic leadership of a Minister Farrakhan, as we have done historically with other people, not simply Minister Farrakhan, and we focus on problems that he may raise or not raise. He has done a number of things that I think many of us would agree with. You know, his call for Million Man March, whether or not you agreed with the Million Man part of it or not, was in fact visionary. It did mobilize more than a million men and women to come here, even though it was predominantly men. But his trip to Africa, we're sidetracking. Some of people agree, some people disagree. I think he has a right to travel. I think he has the right to do what he wants. But I think that we take the attention off of the need, the agenda development. I think the concept that Ben is sharing, and this is the first I've heard of it, and I'd to come on Saturday to hear some of the other discussion. But building from the grassroots is essential.
Right, Audra, and keep in mind the role that the media plays. We have not called a major press conference to announce this for the very reason we did not want the established media playing divide and conquer on us.
Yeah, but I think that NAILS has to become, and one of the things that I think many people Ben are concerned about and have expressed, and I know our organization is looking at, is that the NAILS is a critical organization in concept, but it cannot become an organization that is identified only with one significant leadership, Minister Farrakhan. I wholeheartedly agree and believe that he should be a part of it. You cannot have a national African American leadership summit and not have someone that commands the leadership of so many millions of thousands of black people. But it cannot simply be identified as a Nation of Islam and a Reverend Ben Chavis formation.
Right.
And
we're on the same wavelength.
Exactly.
We're on the same wavelength for that. And we look forward to the active participation and leadership of the National Conference of Black Lawyers, as well as all the other progressive organizational formations that are already organized within the black community. Our goal is to promote unity among the existing organizations.
And I think that the one way that we can do that, because I think that we saw on the floor of NAILS in November, which is why you named ad hoc committee, and I'm hoping on Saturday it can go beyond and get some leadership and be more concrete, is that we must address in very clear and firm ways the issue of gender.
Right.
We have to get women in positions. I mean, I don't want to do he said, she said on the radio, but I think that it's clear that women, even those that we name as being a part of the leadership of NAILS, do not really feel that they are really getting the kind of treatment and the kind of concern to their issues around gender bias, around gender discrimination, that needs to be dealt with not only within the organization but in the broader community. And this has to be something that we take seriously and do more than just be able to identify one or two women that have a leadership role in NAILS, and I'm willing to continue that discussion with you and with people in NAILS. Clearly, I cannot be the leader of that because of my other responsibilities. But I think we really have to take it a much more seriously than I think that we are.
Yes, well, I agree. I mean, again, NAILS itself is evolving. We were founded in 1994. While I was the head of the NAACP.
Exactly.
It's now 2 years later, 1996, and whatever growing pains, and we're not going to duck the issue of gender. We're going to deal with it forthrightly, resolutely, and we're going to move forward.
But, Aju, I guess I would ask, as you say, people shouldn't just focus on Farrakhan. He's part of a coalition. Is it possible, when Louis Farrakhan is part of a coalition, for him not to be the leader and maintain total control? And I go back to the Million Men March. A lot of progressive groups out there who are quite skeptical, and even ones who are involved with the march, not questioning it, are now questioning, for example, where did all the money go? If this was a coalition, who got this money? Maybe I'll put that question to Ben Chavis.
Certainly. You can raise it, but I want to see all the audits from all the other marches that were held on Washington. But we are going to release the audit,
right.
And the audit has been complete. We're designating a time now for it to be released. And it's interesting, people want to know where the money went. The money went to pay for the march itself. No one organization. The Million Man March was incorporated separately from the Nation of Islam.
But, Ben, can I just raise also another point? I think that if, in fact, NAILS, under Ben's convenership at this point, and the other organizations that are at the table now and those that are considering coming to the table, if they do not want Minister Farrakhan to be the leader, but rather to be a part of the leadership, that is the way it will be. That is the decision that those persons forming and leading NAILS have to decide. The issue also, though, is that the media has to understand that if in fact that's the decision of NAILS, that Minister Farrakhan is not the leader, there is still a requirement of responsible media, that the media not paint him as the leader. And I think that's an organizational issue, but I think it's a media issue.
And
well,
Ben,
first of all, I don't have a problem with Minister Farrakhan being in the leadership
summit. Oh, no. He should definitely be there.
Or providing his leadership for the black community. I think some people, we're not going to allow people outside of the black community to tell us who our leader should be.
Dr. Chavis, one other issue. You say you just came from L.A., and they just had, we just heard at the top of the program, the truce, the gang truce movement. That's also happening in Chicago and Minneapolis and other cities. And I know that you were involved with that at one point. Are you still involved? How does that relate to this overall thrust?
Much involved. Some of the gang truce leaders are part of the National African American Leadership Summit. They were with us at First AME Church. We had a celebration. of the Million Man March, of the gang truce, and of building this progressive coalition. I think people were rather surprised to see Minister Farrakhan reach out to Latino, Asian, and other progressive leaders in a setting in the heart of South Central Los Angeles. That's new, and that's progressive, and we all celebrate that.
We do indeed.
I want to thank both of you for joining us. So this is clearly a conversation that will continue. Ajua Ayatoro, Director of the National Conference of Black Lawyers, and let me take this opportunity to express all of our sorrow at the loss of one of your founders, Haywood Burns, who is such an important member of all of our communities, and also Dr. Ben Chavis, convener of the National African American Leadership Summit and Executive Director of the Million Man March. Thank you for joining us, and Salim, thanks for being with us from Chicago. Salim Wakil, who is senior editor at In These Times and a columnist with the Chicago Sun-Times. You're listening to Democracy Now! Up next, the finances of Elizabeth Dole. You're listening to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. What do Elizabeth Hanford Dole and Hillary Rodham Clinton have in common? No, it's not a joke. It's the subject of a recent New Yorker piece called Blind Trust. We've heard a lot about the First Lady's finances, but what about the woman who aspires to that position? New Yorker writer Jane Mayer had a chance to talk with Elizabeth Dole and her former money manager, David Owen, one of Dole's closest friends and advisors and the former finance chair of his earlier presidential bid. Owen was recently released from jail for financial misdoings and feels betrayed by the Doles. Now, earlier in the show today, we reported that the Washington Post is saying today that longtime contributors to Senator Bob Dole began making large donations to the American Red Cross after his wife became the charity's president in 91. For example, ADM chair Dwayne Andreas has given about $1 million. Now, we're going to go back even before that, and we're joined by Jane Mayer now. We want to go into Elizabeth Dole's finances, but why don't you tell us first about who Elizabeth Dole is and where she got her start?
Well, sure. I guess what I found fascinating about Elizabeth Dole was that if there is a woman close to the Oval Office who is a committed career woman who has really pursued power in her own right more than almost any woman who's in the history of the country who's been anywhere near that job, it's Elizabeth Dole. Yet what interested me was she does not seem to have become the target that Hillary Clinton is. And I wondered, you know, why is one woman such a flack catcher, basically, and the other so admired? And so I took some time out to try to figure out how Elizabeth Dole has gotten where she is. And part of it is she's an older generation than Hillary Clinton, and while she knows how to wield power, and she's been a cabinet secretary twice, she's also very charming. She's from the South. She knows how to not to appear so aggressive, I think, in grasping power. Doris Kearns Goodwin said that she you know, has the ability to make it look accidental. She camouflages it, and I think that's probably true.
Let's not skirt over her really meteoric rise to power to where she is now. I mean, she set a lot of precedents. Being a woman, and she also surprised some people in the way she changed politically. Can you trace that history of Elizabeth Dole?
She started out pretty much of an LBJ Democrat when she first came to Washington. She was, among other things, one of the very first women to go through Harvard Law School, which gives you, I think, a sense of the kind of career drive that she has. She's a remarkable, I think, amount of self-discipline and drive.
This was in the late 50s.
This was in the, gosh, I can't remember, I think it was 60s. At any rate, she got to Washington and began working in the Johnson administration as in the Consumer Affairs Department, and then wound up being one of the only people who was held over when Nixon was elected president, which again I think shows you her tremendous sort of survivor skills.
She had worked originally for Betty Furness?
She worked for Betty Furness, and then she went on to work for somebody else in the Nixon administration in Consumer Affairs also. And again, you know, she seemed to be able to see the main chance in a way that maybe other people didn't. And she's, you know, to give her her due, she's very committed, I think, to public service. And she pretty much put off her social life and family life and everything else just to serve in the government.
I was intrigued that you had a quote of Betty Furness just before she died saying, "Whether Elizabeth changed her mind or changed her colors, I don't know. But she went from being a liberal Democrat to changing her affiliation, switching her party registration from Democrat to independent when she began working for Virginia Nauer."
That's true. And then when she married Bob Dole, she changed her registration again from independent to Republican, where I think she's probably likely to stay at this point.
Now, in between working for Virginia Nauer, who was Nixon's consumer affairs person, and working for and marrying Bob Dole, I don't know about working for Bob Dole. I guess you could say that she's working for him now. She had some cabinet appointments again, some firsts for a woman.
Well, it was actually after the consumer jobs, right? She was first Secretary of Transportation and then Secretary of Labor also. And again, these are enormously responsible and powerful jobs that she held, and I think you have to say that she's really got a resume like no other woman in politics. Really, I mean, she was somebody who was talked about seriously as a contender for the White House herself, and so it's interesting.
Still could be.
Well, she's very much made clear, I think, that she does not want to be seen as Hillary Clinton. She did in the interview that she gave me say that this is not going to be a co-presidency if Bob Dole is elected, and I think she's trying very hard to distinguish herself because she sees what a problem it's been for Hillary Clinton.
I want to step back again, and that is during Reagan's years. That's when she was appointed first secretary, a member of the cabinet. She had some problems with the right wing then.
She was seen as not quite right-wing enough on a number of issues, including her early backing for the Equal Rights Amendment, which she then moved away from later. But in some ways, her marriage to Bob Dole helped her very much with the right wing because he was somebody who was seen as a bona fide supporter of the conservative end of the party, and it helped her out quite a bit.
How did her marriage to him shift her views on the Equal Rights Amendment?
Well, I don't know that it did, but I think what happened was that in the Reagan White House, she became convinced that there were other ways to approach equality for women, and she pretty much dropped her support for the actual amendment drive. And I don't know if it was a matter of pragmatism or a change of heart.
Now, you talk about very carefully in the beginning of your piece called Blind Trust in The New Yorker, you talk about her obsession with detail and controlling every aspect of her life, which leads in a very interesting way into the second part of your piece, which is about her finances. And there, you don't quite see that awareness of detail, at least what she professes to know about what happened. Can you talk about some of the things that are sounding a little close to what we're hearing with Hillary Clinton right now in Whitewater?
Well, I guess what I found interesting was that over the years she has made a fair amount of money on investments. She had inherited some money, and for a number of years she had worked with one of Bob Dole's closest advisors, a man named Dave Owen, who also became her financial advisor. And this was in years before she had a blind trust, and they made money on a number of deals together. And she seemed, when I interviewed her, to not really remember anything about it. It may be because Owen subsequently became an embarrassment. He was indicted and in fact, convicted on a felony count for having to do with his taxes, not properly handling his income taxes. So at any rate, she didn't seem to remember too much about her own financial affairs, even though she'd made some money on some pretty unusual ventures, including one was something called Gulf Fund, where she had loaned this man, Dave Owen, $250,000 of her own money to make golf TV tip shows. And it was strange because the other investors who had put money into it, including Owen, had lost their shirts, but he had somehow seen to it that she was paid back when no one else was, which, and the question was, why did she get her money back? And in fact, she got paid back quite a bit of interest also, when other people didn't seem to be. I spoke to one of the other investors, and he was pretty concerned about it still these, 10 years later. And I get, the issue for Hillary Clinton down in Arkansas has been, did she have somebody who was making it possible for her to make money without, suffering the risks in the commodities market? And if so, that's kind of a favor to perform for someone. What did this person expect in return? And I think some of those questions could be asked about Elizabeth Dole also.
You also talk about the State Bank of Stanley and a loan that Elizabeth Dole got that she ultimately gave to her husband.
Yeah, I think it was 1979, Dole was again running for president and was very hard strapped for cash, and she managed to get a loan from this bank, which was run by her husband's friend Dave Owen, her investment counselor Dave Owen, and the loan was at below market interest rates, and the whole thing was something that the FEC spent a lot of time looking into later, and they kind of issued a statement that suggested it didn't sound right, but they couldn't say that it was wrong.
Did you interview Elizabeth Dole in Washington or in the somewhat questionable office building she owns in Kansas called Overland Park?
Actually, I interviewed her at Dole's campaign headquarters here in Washington, but I spoke to Dave Owen in Overland Park. That's where Mrs. Dole continues to own an office building that he sold to her there.
David Owen, the former finance chair of Dole's presidential campaign, tell us about the office building.
It's so complicated, really. I mean, it's the point was that she bought the office building, or he became the manager of Blind Trust, and as such, he bought the office building for her. And then less than a year later, he turned around and sold half of it to another person at a huge profit to her, and the other person was someone that her husband had gotten a minority business contract for through the Senate office. He'd been a former aide to Dole. So again, it was uncomfortably cozy. It raised questions about whether or not she'd been able to make money in ways that ordinary citizens don't because of the prominence of her husband.
Now, May, also, what about how separate her finances are from her husband? In fact, that was raised in the Stanley Bank case, with her giving a loan to her husband and giving a lot of money to him, and yet she has alleged all along that her finances are separate, and so she could be considered a campaign contributor if she's going to give him money.
Well, what's interesting is she has argued it both ways at different times in her life. If the money had belonged to her at the time that she got the loan in 1979, then the FEC would have found it as an illegal contribution. But she argued at the time that it was their joint money, so that it didn't break the law. She's later argued that the money is only hers. In any case, it's. I have to say that it's something that Mrs. Dole says she doesn't care too much about. Finances have never been a major interest to her. She hasn't followed any of the details. She said she couldn't remember any of these instances or almost any of them, and she referred me to her lawyer and to others who might be more aware of her finances. It raised questions with me because she is a trained lawyer and somebody who is an absolute fiend for detail.
Mm-hmm. I was also intrigued by the story in 1986. Now, Dave Owen tells you the story about how Dole was pressuring him to raise money for a Kansas gubernatorial candidate who he actually didn't like. But he did raise the money, $35,000, and got it to him by something that has become quite familiar now. In fact, in the Dole campaign, we recently heard about Aqua Leisure bundling money, giving money to workers, and then the workers giving that money back to the Dole campaign. He's denying that that's true, but it looks like there's a little history here of this kind of thing.
There's the real history of this kind of bundling campaign contribution back in Kansas. And I guess what I think it suggests is that the kinds of issues that are being raised about the Clintons' finances could probably be raised about the Doles, and maybe, I hate to say it, almost anybody else's. And, this then should raise the question in many people's minds, I think, about how pertinent this is, how polluted is the contribution system in this country. And I think, I have to say that I think it's pretty widespread And that there are abuses all over the place.
And yet you have both President Clinton and the Senate Majority Leader Robert Dole fighting campaign finance reform.
You do, and you also have, in this particular case, Dole saying that he knew nothing about this. In this, and there are a number of other cases that also involve money raising in Kansas for various other campaigns of his, and he said that they were Owens, this fellow Dave Owens' problem, not his. Owen is really, I think, deadly bitter at Dole for what he sees as cutting him off and betraying him for this. But Dole says that it was very much Owen's own gig, and he knew nothing of it.
We're talking to Jane Mayer. She is author of a piece called Blind Trust in the New Yorker magazine. Jane, you have written about politics over the last year. I've been following Dole and Ken Starr, also President Clinton himself and his advisors. You did a piece called... What was it called?
Lonely Guy.
You did a piece called Lonely Guy. Tell us about your view of President Clinton and how he's conducting White House affairs.
Well, gosh, it really wasn't my view. I'm a reporter, not a pundit, really. It was a piece that was a reported piece about the rise of Dick Morris in the White House, who I think is a consultant many people are now familiar with, but it was the first piece about him, really. He's somebody who is sort of seen by some in the White House as a Svengali who's advising Clinton on how to take positions in order to become popular rather than to take positions out of principle. And so it was really a piece about this whole issue of Dick Morris's influence. And the reason we called it Lonely Guy was just that Clinton seemed at the time to be cutting himself off from a number of Democrats who were not seen as very popular around the country, particularly the liberal Democrats.
Why do you think he sees it in his interest to do that?
Well, at that time, I think, you know, he could see that the electorate was moving to the center, if not to the right. It was the summer after the 94 landslide congressional elections that brought Newt Gingrich to become speaker. And, you know, I have to say that what he's done in retrospect, basically the strategy that Morris concocted really has done well for Clinton.
Now, there was a little controversy around Dick Morris working with Republicans at the same time he was working with Clinton.
Right. This piece sort of laid out the fact that he was working with Trent Lott, who at the same time that he was working for Clinton. And, you know, people wondered if there weren't sort of back channels of information going back and forth at the same time. And Morris, in fact, is someone who has said in the past that his greatest hope was to see that the Republican Party become cemented as the majority party. So, you know, you had to wonder why it was that Clinton had chose him, of all people, to be his most confidential consultant. But they have a relationship going way back, and Morris has pretty much saved Clinton from electoral disaster in the past before, and I think Clinton pretty much saw that he might be in great peril again, and he pulled the guy out who had saved him in the past, hoping he could do the same again.
I have a last question about Elizabeth Dole. Today, the Washington Post reports that several interests controlled by the chair of Archer Daniels Midland, ADM, Duane Andreas, have given about $3 million to the Red Cross since Elizabeth Hanford Dole assumed her post. And they also quote a private ethics watchdog as saying it poses a conflict with her husband's government status. Is she going to keep her job as president of the Red Cross if Bob Dole becomes president?
She has said she'd like to go back to it. And, you know, she's somebody who does not sit idly by. You know, if Hillary Clinton made jokes about not wanting to sit around and baking cookies, well, Mrs. Dole is not a cookie baker either.
I was covering a Republican party last year during the first 100 days when the Doles came in, and Robert Dole joked, we're not exactly the most welcome couple at any party. I ask for money, she asks for blood.
Right. Well, they have a real sort of 1-2 routine going. They've been doing it for years. And you know, I mean, and he is very funny, and she's got an appreciative sense of humor. So anyway, I think she is in many ways one of his best assets out there.
Did you investigate at all the ADM connection, the Archer Daniels Midland connection of the co-op they bought in Bell Harbor that was actually bought in, what, her name and her brother's name at below market rate?
Right. It was. I didn't go into it at any great length because people had already done really good work documenting that. And I was trying to look at what people don't already know. Basically, I'd heard that this fellow, Dave Owen, was out there and might finally talk to a reporter. So when I got a hold of him, I really wanted to hear what he had to say. I was trying to tell a news story.
Jane Mayer, writer for The New Yorker magazine. Her piece on Elizabeth Dole is called Blind Trust. Thank you very much for joining us. And before we leave today, we want to welcome KRCL in Salt Lake City, Utah, and KBOO in Portland, Oregon. I'll be in Portland on Saturday giving two talks, one on the elections and one on my experiences in Indonesian-occupied East Timor. You can call KBOO for details on where and when the talks will be. I look forward to meeting KBOO listeners. Democracy Now! Is produced by Julie Drizin with help from Pat Greenfield. Kenneth Mason is our engineer. You can buy a cassette of today's show or any of Democracy Now! Programs by calling 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. Tomorrow, a debate on U.S. policy in Israel and Lebanon. We'll be talking with reporters in Lebanon as well as Jerusalem. And we'll be talking about Latino registration. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening.